From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Happy New Year. This is a reflective time as we try to make sense of the past year and look ahead to the new one. So we thought it might be a good time to hear from two men who have pondered life's mysteries. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the Dalai Lama's translator and a former Tibetan monk, Geshe Thupten Jinpa. He not only translates Western concepts for the Dalai Lama, he explains Buddhist concepts to Westerners. And we hear from the Dalai Lama's youngest brother, Tenzin Shogyal. He and the Dalai Lama fled Tibet after the Chinese invasion and have since lived in exile in India. Tenzin Shogyal spent his youth in a Buddhist monastery and now serves on the Tibetan parliament in exile. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year. We think of the new year as a time to take stock of the past and make resolutions for the future. We thought this would be an interesting day to hear about reflection from a Buddhist point of view. Geshe Thupten Jinpa was born in Tibet in 1958 and fled with his family to India after the failed 1959 Tibetan uprising against the Chinese occupation. At the age of 11, he entered a Buddhist monastery run by Tibetan monks in exile. For the past 9 years, he's been the chief translator for the Dalai Lama, the exiled spiritual and political head of the Tibetan people. Jinpa now lives in England, where he has been studying Western culture and philosophy, so he can act as a bridge between the East and the West. I spoke with him last spring after he translated a new book by the Dalai Lama called The World of Tibetan Buddhism. I asked him about the first time he met the Dalai Lama.
Well, I first met him when I was just a boy, at the age of 7. I was in a kindergarten school, and I may have been actually 5 or 6. And His Holiness visited the school, and I remember because I was chosen as the boy, you know, we had a boy and a girl, to offer him flower garland. So I was chosen as the boy.
Did that have an impact on you?
Definitely. And since then, I've always wanted to become a monk, because after that, I've had exposure to several monks. You know, I've met them mainly in the schools. They were teachers. And to me, all these monks have, you know, sort of symbolized a kind of a life of serenity. And they were all, you know, extremely compassionate and gentle, yet strong. So for me, they have always been a kind of a, you know, hero.
I believe you decided when you were 11 that you wanted to go to a monastery and study to be ordained?
That's right. Actually, I was studying in a normal school in Simla, which is the northern part of India, which used to be the summer capital during the British Raj. Beautiful part of India. And somehow in the school, I didn't feel contented, because from an early age, I've wanted to do something sort of, you know, deep and profound. And, you know, sort of I've always enjoyed the intellectual challenge of thinking. And for me, monkhood represented a life of intellectual scholarship in pursuit of, you know, philosophy and scholarship. So at the age of 11, I left the school against my father's will. I mean, he was totally against it. He felt that by leaving school, I was in some sense wasting a wonderful opportunity to become a bread earner for the family, because, you know, refugee families, you know, they, you know, for them it was very important that their children go to school, go to university, get a job and support the family. So my father was completely against it, but I insisted and joined the monastery.
Is it unusual for an 11-year-old to, on his own free will, join a monastery?
Yes, it is. Normally what happens in the case of a monk is that at an earlier age, about 8 or 9, the parents would make the choice for the children to be sent to a monastery.
You know, most boys and girls who are 11, 12, 13, they're just so full of energy. They're just kind of bouncing around. It's very difficult for teachers to keep them focused, to keep young students focused on anything, especially when those hormones start to kick in.
That's true.
At around 13. So what was it like for you then to be in this discipline setting of the monastery?
Well, you know, intellectually speaking, it is rather, you know, it is quite disciplined. But I mean, if anyone has seen Buddhist monks debating in the debating courtyard, and by the way, much of the debating occurs outside in a courtyard, mm-hmm. and it's a very physical act. You know, it's almost like a sort of a dance, where you see, you know, monks standing and some sitting down and clapping and stamping their feet, and the debate and the exchange of the debate is very spontaneous, and often it is kind of a meditation, you know, while you are there, you know, physically and emotionally and also intellectually absorbed in this discourse, you know, discussion with either one person or many people, together in a group, you automatically get sort of transported onto a quite a different plane of mind. And there is definitely a lot of freedom and activity there. And I feel that, and also in the monastery, there is a much greater appreciation of the, you know, the basic sort of, you know, character of the human mind. There is no expectation of a monk just because he has taken a, you know, monastic vow. There is no expectation that he should act, you know, completely holy or, you know, beyond sort of, you know, human capacity. So there is a much greater sort of humanity. There's much sort of much more humor and I would say just simple ordinariness.
How did you become the Dalai Lama's translator?
Oh, it was actually quite interesting. I was at that time based in South India, studying in one of the monastic universities. And in 1985, I went up to Dharamsala, where His Holiness is based. This is in the northern part of India, which is quite far away, you know, more than 1,000 kilometers away. And I went to see my sister, who was at that time in school there. And when I reached Dharamsala, it so happened that His Holiness was scheduled to give a series of teachings at the request of a group from Los Angeles from the next day. And the resident interpreter at that time wasn't in town. And, you know, they were expecting him only a day after the teaching, would begin. So they were looking for someone to stand in for him just for a day. And the word got around that, I have a reasonably good command of English and also have a good, Tibetan philosophical monastic training. So I was approached, and I, you know, at that time, you know, I must admit that let alone having any sort of wish to translate for His Holiness, I even haven't dreamed of being able to do such a thing. So I said, look, you know, I haven't done anything like that, and especially for His Holiness, you know, I won't even have the you know, if you want, the guts to do it. anyway, I was asked to do it. And then since then, I've been working for him as his, you know, key interpreter. So it's mainly sort of, you know, different circumstances. And so it's more out of coincidence.
What's it like to be around him?
It is wonderful. Not only spiritually, it is extremely inspiring, but it is also deeply encouraging. And I personally feel whenever I'm traveling with him and working for him, I feel a tremendous sense of encouragement and also a boost in my own self-confidence. Because for me, he represents what is the best in the potential of human existence, what could be achieved, you know, as a human being, especially in terms of his discipline, in terms of his genuineness, in his compassion towards other fellow human beings, and also the spontaneity and the tremendous sense of confidence in his own mission and in his own ability to interact and touch people at the deepest level. And I find that, you know, very inspiring.
My guest is Geshe Thubten Jinpa, and he is the translator for the Dalai Lama. Are there certain Buddhist concepts or stories that are particularly difficult to translate into English?
Yes, there are some concepts which are quite difficult to translate, and also which requires a certain degree of reorientation of one's own outlook, and also some concepts which have a potential for misunderstanding and misinterpretation. For example, like the doctrine of karma is sometimes misunderstood as a kind of a fatalistic doctrine, that because such and such a person has done some bad act in the past, you know, the suffering that he's, you know, undergoing now is something that he deserves, and it is his bad luck. There is that potential for misinterpretation of some of the, you know, basic ideas of Buddhism. Whereas if you look at the idea, the concept itself in its proper context, then you will see that there is no grounds for, you know, reading such fatalistic sort of, you know, interpretation into it.
So, yeah, I think karma is often translated into the West as what goes around comes around.
Yes, that's right. And also some people think it's a fate, mm-hmm. whereas the actual original word karma has a much more proactive connotation, and literally it means action.
Are there Western ways of thinking that have been difficult for you to translate to the Dalai Lama?
I remember, generally speaking, His Holiness's English is very good. So luckily, you know, I don't have to translate that much back into Tibetan. But I do remember this was quite a while ago in California, there was a conference on Buddhism and psychotherapy, a dialogue. And at the conference, there were, you know, panelists, you know, all of whom were practicing psychotherapists or psychoanalysts. And the question of self-hatred and sort of, you know, based on low self-esteem came up. And His Holiness, you know, couldn't believe there is such a thing as self-hatred. You know, he kept shaking his head and he said, how come, you know, everybody, you know, at a deep down will love themselves, you know, will be attached to themselves, you know, would want to live, you know, how is it possible? I mean, he felt that the very concept of self-hatred was in some sense incoherent. You know, it doesn't make any sense. So I remember the panelist, you know, spending at least 5 to 10 minutes trying to convince him that there is such a thing, that the concept is not only coherent, but there are people, you know, who suffer from this problem. So that was one situation, you know, one incident where, you know, I saw that there were certain concepts, you know, particularly coming from Western psychology, which were quite difficult to understand.
That's so interesting to me, the whole idea of finding the concept of self-hatred incomprehensible.
Yes. and the psychologists, I mean, they were so sort of, you know, surprised, and they mm-hmm. were so amazed. And you know, after the conference was over, you know, they started asking me, you know, they were saying, does that mean, you know, no Tibetans suffer from self-hatred? Does that mean no Tibetans have low self-esteem? And I said, I honestly don't know.
Geshe Thubten Jinpa is the Dalai Lama's translator. Our interview was recorded last spring. Coming up, we hear from the Dalai Lama's youngest brother. This is Fresh Air. Tenzin Shogyal is the youngest brother of the Dalai Lama, the spiritual and political leader of the Tibetan Buddhists. They both fled Tibet in 1959 after the Chinese invasion and have since lived in exile in Dharamsala, India. Tenzin Shogyal is a member of the Tibetan Parliament in exile and has served as a special assistant to the Dalai Lama. Last year, the Dalai Lama announced that a 6-year-old boy in Tibet was designated as the next Panchen Lama, the second highest monk in Tibetan Buddhism. The Dalai Lama asked the Chinese occupying government of Tibet to allow the boy to undergo monastic training. But the Chinese government in Tibet claimed it has the right to decide who the next Panchen Lama is. Last month, the Chinese government enthroned the boy it chose. The Dalai Lama called the enthronement invalid and illegal. The Buddhists find the Chinese government's position absurd, since the Lama is not a political appointment. It is the person who is believed to be the reincarnation of the previous Lama. I asked Tenzin Shogyal to explain the Buddhist belief that the soul of a dead spiritual leader is reincarnated in a newborn baby.
Now, the whole concept of reincarnation, it's based on karma. Karma means cause and effect. Now, all the causes that we have made in one life, when we die, the result will also sometimes, you know, surface in the next life. In other words, that is a transmigration of the consciousness. Our mental continuum continues to, surface through all the forms that might, reborn as, and we call that reincarnation. In other words, all sentient beings are reincarnates. Now, in the case of the Dalai Lama, Panchen Lama, and other high lamas, they are reincarnates who are recognized as particular reincarnation of a particular person. So Dalai Lama and Panchen Lama belongs to the latter category.
Now, how are they discovered?
Well, there are various methods of discovery. Some will show signs when they are being born. Say a house in which a high lama is born, there'll be auspicious signs like, repeated rainbows, then a strange phenomena of rain being fallen without any clouds, and then also dreams by the parents or by the devotees of that particular lama. And then sometimes, mediums who go into trance and become oracles can also make predictions. So there are all sorts of ways.
Now, your brother, your older brother, is the Dalai Lama. What were the signs that he was the reincarnation of the previous Dalai Lama?
Now, regarding the 14th Dalai Lama, now, during that time, when the 13th Dalai Lama passed away, there was a period during which Tibet was ruled by a regent. Now, the name of the regent was Rading Rinpoche, and he went to a lake in central Tibet, which is connected with a protective deity of all Dalai Lamas and all, government of Tibet's patron deity, Pandel Hamo. Now, in that lake, this regent saw three letters which indicated Akama. A means Amdo, that's the province. And then Ka stands for Kumbum, that's the nearest big town, town to the village where the present Dalai Lama was born. So he saw in this lake a clear visions indicating that where the Dalai Lama will be born. Then he also saw the house of the present Dalai Lama in Amdo.
When your brother, the Dalai Lama, was discovered as the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama, were there tests that were given to make sure that this was the right boy?
Yes, there were tests. And the test consists of the boy having to select all duplicate articles, and the articles which belong to the 13th Dalai Lama, and they are sort of paired with new ones which are made more attractively, more colorful, and they were kept in front of the boy and asked the boy to choose. And the 14th Dalai Lama, he chose all the correct objects. Then also he recognized one member of the delegation who was in the search party as being a monk from Sera Monastery. He said Sera Aka, Sera Aka means monk from Sera.
What was your parents' reaction when your brother was chosen as the new Dalai Lama? Were they shocked?
Yeah, I suppose so, yes. You know, something just like lightning having struck the house or something like that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother told me that when His Holiness the Dalai Lama was born, at that time my father was quite ill. But on the particular day of his birth, my father recovered from his illness and he was feeling very well. And then he went to the family altar and lit a, you know, butter lamp and made a pledge that this boy shall be a monk.
What did your parents do? What kind of work did they do?
My parents were farmers. Making a living out of, you know, growing barley, wheat, peas, then mustard. And then we also had quite a lot of domestic animals. Yeah, so we were farmers.
How old were you when your brother was chosen?
I wasn't born.
Uh-huh.
I'm the youngest.
So when you grew up, you knew all along that your brother was being groomed to be the spiritual and
yes.
political leader of his people.
Right. That is 12 years difference between His Holiness and me.
Do you know the concept of sibling rivalry?
Yes, I know. I know very well, yes.
I mean, were you ever jealous of your brother? Or was it just so phenomenally
no, His
different
Holiness
than
always
that?
Teases me, saying that I had more time to be breastfed than he himself. So therefore, he's a little jealous, I suppose.
Now, did you grow up with him, or was he taken away to a distant monastery for special
His
training?
His Holiness was recognized as the 14th Dalai Lama from the age of 3, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think by the time he came up to Lhasa, he was, I think, 4, going to be 4. And then he was kept, in Dalai Lama's residence during summer in Obalinka and during winter in Potala. But my mother and family members, they had access to him, and he could visit, you know, our father and our mother whenever he liked.
Now, you know, I think it's probably difficult for a lot of people to understand the concept of
reincarnation.
Reincarnation, and also of a spiritual leader being recognized as a child.
Yes.
On the other hand, you know, in the Christian story, baby Jesus is,
yes.
you know, Jesus is recognized as a baby and is, revered even as a baby.
And,
he
is interpreted as Son of God. So I think there is an element of theory of reincarnation.
I know you were brought up in a Catholic schooling. Do you see connections between the Christ story
and?
Elements of Tibetan Buddhism, or is that really stretching it?
Yes. I think there is a tremendous element of similarity with Buddhism, with the New Testament, what you read in the New Testament, particularly Christ's teaching on Sermon on the Mount, 8 Beatitude. All these are very, very similar to Buddhist thinking.
Tenzin Shogyal is the Dalai Lama's youngest brother and is a member of the Tibetan Parliament in exile. He lives in Dharamsala, India. Our interview was recorded last April. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our interview with Tenzin Shogyal, the youngest brother of the Dalai Lama. He says that as a Tibetan Buddhist, he should be able to forgive the Chinese for taking over his country. Yet, there are times he wishes he could fight back. and so he's torn. But when he discusses this with his brother, the Dalai Lama just laughs at Shaogyal's predicament. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tenzin Shogyal, the youngest brother of the Dalai Lama, the spiritual and political leader of the Tibetan Buddhists. They both fled Tibet in 1959 after the Chinese invasion and have since lived in exile in Dharamsala, India. What do you remember about the Chinese invasion? How old were you then?
I was 5 that time. Maybe late 4, going into 5. That was in 1949-50, yes.
Was it a very frightening period for you as a child?
No, I don't think so, because I was too young to realize the magnitude of the situation. It's very interesting. Probably the earliest memory that I have is of my life. It's that the morning that we were leaving Lhasa towards the Indian border in 1950, and we started very early in the morning. And my brother, Lobsang Samden, was little ill. He couldn't walk properly. So he was coming down to the courtyard of the house where my mother was about to, you know, ride the horse. Then I could see my mother's outline and my brother's outline against the stars of the morning sky. And that's the earliest memory that I have. So to answer your question, no, I wasn't frightened. I thought it's a good opportunity to go somewhere else.
Yeah, when you fled...
This was in 1950. But 1959, experience is something totally different. I was 13 that time.
Did you flee from Tibet with your brother, the Dalai Lama?
Yes, on the same day, same night.
In the same group?
Yes, yes. Not together, but later on we became one group. From Nobilinka, we left... We crossed the river towards the south in small batches. But after some time, after a few days, we were together, yes.
Can you share some of your memories as a 13-year-old boy fleeing Tibet to India?
Yes, yes. On the day of the escape, you know, just I think about 1 hour before the escape, my mother told me that I should go and change into secular dress. I was wearing a monk's robe that time. And she told me that we are going to some kind of a nunnery in southern Tibet. But then I knew probably we are going to escape to India. And then I went to change, and I had borrowed some one pistol. I had tucked it into my belt. I was carrying extra bullets. And, a 13-year-old boy, ready to have a fight with the Chinese soldiers. And then at about 9:30, some soldiers came and told us that we are supposed to leave the house. And I couldn't help laughing at my mother and my sister, who were dressed as men. And so in a very serious situation, I was laughing all the time.
they were dressed as men to disguise themselves?
Yes, yes. So we left the house.
And they fooled the soldiers at the door?
Yes, I think so. But I think the soldiers who were manning that gate probably knew what was happening. Yes. So anyway, we cross into empty land between the river and Novolinka. And then after some time, we could see the lights of the Chinese camp down in the southwest of Novolinka. And I don't think at one point they are, you know, not too far. Say the distance could be about 300 to 500 meters. We could see at the see the lights of the camp very, very vividly, very clearly. And luckily, the wind, you know, direction of the wind was from the Chinese campsite towards the east. So therefore, some of, you know, elders who were with me, they were saying that it's good that so that they won't hear. And then we crossed the river. And once we have crossed the river, we were waiting for our horses. And when we about to get the horses, a batch of, you know, riders passed by. And then people said, His Holiness has just passed. So that's what I remember. And that time I didn't feel anything. But now if I sort of look back, I don't think I could do it again because it's a very serious situation.
You know too much now to have done it so fearlessly.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
You said you had a pistol with you. Would it have been against the teachings of Tibetan Buddhism to have used it?
I think that time I would have used it, but now I hesitate.
What's the difference between now and then? Is it your age or something else?
No, because if you kill somebody, you know, sooner or later, you will be killed. And just as you don't want to be shot, I don't think it's right to shoot other people. This is my present conviction.
You know, earlier we were talking about how spiritual leaders are discovered as the reincarnation of their predecessors. And I believe that you were recognized as the reincarnation of a scholar who established many monasteries in Tibet.
Yes, from the age of 3, I became a hostage.
A hostage?
Yes, because I didn't say I'm a reincarnate. So I was sort of recognized against my own, you know, free will.
Gee, what an interesting thing to think about, that you'd be recognized as somebody who you didn't feel like you were.
Well, to tell you very frankly, I don't remember anything. Yes.
You don't remember anything about that period?
No, I mean, all I know is
The past, you mean, right.
Yeah, there's nothing special about me. But, you know, I'm recognized as one of the reincarnates of one Dharma whose name is Ngari Rinpoche. Yeah.
So how has your life changed when you were recognized as the reincarnation?
My life changed?
I mean, were you expected to go into
to
be a monk after that?
Yes, I was brought up as a monk. Then from the age of 7, I went to a small monastery. Then from the age of 8, I entered the biggest monastery in the world. That's Daewoong Monastic University. Yes, and I did we Tibetan monks study. And I studied there 8, 9, 10, I think 4 years. And then 59, we had to escape. So I spent 4 years in formal education in Daewoong Monastic University. Yes.
No, I understand that you gave up your title as the reincarnation.
No, I didn't give up. I disrobed as a monk.
Uh-huh.
But I still carry the, you know, title of Ngari Rinpoche, and people still recognize me as Ngari Rinpoche.
I see.
Yes, but I'm not a monk or a celibate.
Now, is it acceptable to be considered the reincarnation of Rinpoche and then decide to not be a monk? Monks often do?
Yes, it's not unprecedented.
Okay, that's the word I was looking for, right.
Yes. Yes.
So it wasn't like a horrible thing for you to decide
do
that?
Definitely not.
And you weren't condemned by your people or anything?
Oh, no. Uh-huh. You know, in our society, when a monk or a nun wants to disrobe, there is no stigma. There is no stigma. And, you know, people don't think it's some kind of, you know, how do you say, something shocking that we don't. Yeah.
Would it be too personal to ask you why you wanted to leave the monastery?
No, I felt that I didn't have a vocation to be a monk. And I didn't want to live a life that has, you know, I didn't want to live a life with the inner unresolved conflict. So I thought, you know, I want to become lay, and then I got married.
Did you feel like you had something resembling a calling as a lay person?
Well, I feel much more comfortable after becoming a lay person. Yes, I have a calling to be a lay person. Yes.
Now, you're a member of the Tibetan Parliament in exile.
Yes.
What kind of business does that parliament handle?
Well, the parliament, it's the legislative body of the Tibetan government in exile. And the legislative have two roles. One is, since it's an infant democracy, we have to crystallize those democratic principles in the form of laws. So since 1991, we intensified, you know, democratic principles. So we met and tried to, you know, introduce a lot of laws. And then the other duty is to check the executive part of the government. And my wife belongs to that that part. And so we have to keep an eye on the executive branch of the government. Yes, these are the jobs.
Would you like to return to Tibet sometime?
Oh, definitely. Now? Oh, yes. When Tibet is free.
Do you think it will be?
I have no doubt about it.
My guest is Tenzin Shogyal. He's the Dalai Lama's youngest brother and is a member of the Tibetan Parliament in exile. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tenzin Shogyal, the Dalai Lama's youngest brother. You know, recently on our program, we had on the Dalai Lama's translator, Geshen Thupten.
Yes.
And he told us something, and everybody who's heard this interview has commented on this one thing that he said. He said that he was once translating for the Dalai Lama at a psychotherapy conference.
Yes.
And the concept of low self-esteem came up.
Yes.
And the Dalai Lama was just absolutely baffled.
Yes.
By this concept. He found it incomprehensible, and every therapist tried very hard to explain to him the meaning of low self-esteem.
Yes, it's a form of depression, actually.
Do you find it impossible to understand, too? Or, I mean, I've been trying to figure out whether the Dalai Lama...
Low self-esteem?
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out whether the Dalai Lama couldn't understand it, because it's a concept so foreign to...
You see, if you have little understanding or have a deep, or try to learn, you know, the meaning of causality, that whatever position that we are in now has come from a cause. So cause and effect is supreme. So if you want to go into a better position or get a better job or have a more mature way of thinking, you have to apply the right cause. And then if you apply the cause, the desired result will be achieved. So therefore, in this thinking, there should be no reason for people to feel depressed, which I feel is the root of having a feel of, you know, low self-esteem.
I know in day-to-day life in America, a lot of people are just generally dissatisfied and depressed, often with their job.
Yes.
And have no idea how to change it.
Yes. But I think firstly, you know, if you have a job and you feel that if you get another job that you will be happier, or in other words, I have, say, $20, then if I feel that if I have another 20, I'll be happier, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get that 20, I don't think you feel happier. As a matter of fact, you become more greedy. So therefore, to be content in a wise way probably becomes basis of happiness. Otherwise, there's want, 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 and you don't know when to say enough. So in other words, our desire to acquire things, our desire to become more rich, becomes a monster which eats you up, actually. And then you're always perturbed and you never have mental peace. So what I'm trying to say earlier is that, you know, we hold our own destiny in our own hands. You know, there's no external force that's going to deliver you. Now that is when you think about causality. Everything has a cause, and that cause will have an effect, and that effect becomes another cause. And the mover of the mover becomes ultimately your intention or how you feel about yourself. So I'm talking about being self-reliant.
In the documentary that you're featured in called Shadow Over Tibet, Stories in Exile,
yes,
you talk a little bit about how torn you are between wanting to get even with the Chinese and wanting to be very kind of peaceful about everything.
Yes, yes.
So
yes.
What? Maybe you could talk with us a little bit about the conflict that you feel over how to respond to
Now, as a person who's going to be 50 and who have some kind of access to spiritual life or teachings, I feel that violence is not right. Now, that's the intellectual part of me. Now, there is a sentimental part of me, you know, which most of the time predominates, you know, a person, and me too. And on that level, I feel very bitter about the, you know, Chinese government and those Chinese who are responsible for all the things that they have done in my country. So that's what I feel. And I suppose I have to adjust these two so that, I become harmonious once again. You know what I mean?
Yes, yeah, because you feel torn now.
Yes.
You know, it seems so confusing to me how, an occupying force does not, you know, kindly leave. You can't ask an occupying force to please leave my country.
But there is such thing as retreat.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you've been hoping for?
I think the Chinese has to retreat, yes. Because I feel that the way China is heading, I don't think the center can hold very much longer. Probably, you know, once Deng Xiaoping dies, or once we know that the old man is dead, and when the Chinese people know, I think there will be many, many polarities of power in China. So probably China will be going back to, you know, just like the warlord days of 1920s. And this time, instead of the warlords, probably regional military commanders.
There have been many Tibetans and many Tibetan monks and nuns who have been imprisoned, tortured, killed during the Chinese occupation of Tibet.
Yes.
And I wonder what it's been like for you and for friends and colleagues of yours to not arm against the Chinese, knowing the kind of suffering that the occupation has resulted in.
Uh-huh, yes. As I said before, you know, unless I'm angry, my sentimental part don't come in. I think it's completely wrong to, use violence, because once you kill a Chinese, sooner or later, when they have a chance, they will also take revenge again. So therefore, this vicious circle has to be stopped. And just as I don't want to be killed, and I don't want to kill too. Now, the thing is, we have to use this non-violence approach in such a way that it's applicable in the context of Chinese mentality. Right now, when we say non-violence, I think the Chinese have nothing but contempt, because they cannot appreciate non-violence.
I think a lot of people have contempt for the concept. A lot of people think that it's cowardice in disguise, an intellectual form of cowardice.
But, you know, nonviolence can be very active. It can be very, it's not passive, it's active, it can be dynamic. So we have to find that, and we couldn't head it off right now.
Now, what do you feel has been the active, dynamic part of your passivism?
No, we could do something that's loud, but that doesn't kill anybody. So probably this is the formula.
Now, have you met people who have fled from Tibet?
Yes, I have.
Who were tortured there, who suffered a lot there.
Yes,
who have been able to maintain their belief in a passive form of resistance as opposed to arming
I think
themselves.
There is, on a mental level, which is not vocal, I think there is a tremendous amount of passive resistance. Now, that passive resistance, I don't know how it'll find expression. You know what I mean? So the situation is very, very explosive. I personally feel that when we have the opportunity, particularly our people who have lived under Chinese occupation for the last 36 years, when they have the opportunity, probably they'll go into a rampage and, carry out a lot of reprisal in the form of violence. That's what I feel.
My guest is Tenzin Shogyal, the Dalai Lama's youngest brother and a member of the Tibetan Parliament in exile. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tenzin Shogyal, he's the Dalai Lama's youngest brother and a member of the Tibetan Parliament in exile. Before you were saying, you told us that you're in conflict, two sides of yourself, the side that's interested in almost fighting China to end the occupation, and the side which is the more dominant side that believes that it would be a terrible mistake to fight back.
Yes.
Have you ever talked to your brother, the Dalai Lama, about that division that you feel?
Yes, I have.
What does he say? Could you share
all
that?
I get back, it's a big laugh.
A big laugh?
Yes. He thinks it's a stupid situation.
What you're feeling, or the situation in Tibet is stupid?
No. How I sort of, my position, probably he finds it very childish.
Well, no, what does he find childish about it?
This conflict that I have, that my head says, nonviolence, and my heart says, a little bit of violence. So this conflict.
But no, why does he find that child? I mean, that seems so natural to me. I mean, most of us live in a state of division about nearly everything. But
yeah, that's true. On a conventional level, yes, this is quite normal. But on an empirical meaning, then this conflict should not arise. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, I think we are just trying to activate some kind of illness, which sometimes we enjoy, sometimes we don't. Then probably in my case, if I analyze more, then probably it's the romantic side in me. You know what I'm saying?
So your brother, the Dalai Lama, thinks that the part of you that wants a little bit of violence is giving
side.
In to instincts that you're really above, and that...
Uh-huh. Yes.
And how does it make you feel when he laughs when you tell him about what's tearing you apart?
Well, sometimes you feel very stupid. Yes, I feel kind of stupid sometimes.
But you would never feel, well, he doesn't appreciate how torn I am and how much agony this is causing me.
No, I think His Holiness really understands people. You know, whether it be a Tibetan or a non-Tibetan, whether someone who has spiritual value or someone who doesn't have spiritual value, He really gives you His 100% attention. But then to each He will respond in a different way. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But His attention is 100%. And He really make you feel that He has listened to you. And even though He won't say anything, just by eye contact, you feel that you have been understood. You know what I'm saying?
I think so.
Yes.
Not that I've necessarily experienced it.
Yes.
It does seem to me, if you don't mind my saying, that you laugh in surprising spots yourself. You know, that when you talk about the periods when you're in the most pain, that's when you're very likely to laugh. Here we go.
Yes, yeah. I do laugh a lot, yes.
For example.
Yes.
So does it always seem slightly absurd to you, your own predicaments?
Yes, yes, yes. And in a deep level, life is absurd. I mean, what we do mostly, and we think it's very important. But if you really sit back and think, practically 99% of the things that we do and say, it's absurd. You know what I'm saying?
I do, and yet for most of us, the pain, the pain and the discomfort, the kind of day-to-day...
Well, no pain, no gain.
Right. Tenzin Shogyal is the Dalai Lama's youngest brother and is a member of the Tibetan Parliament in exile. He lives in Dharamsala, India. Our interview was recorded last April. Well, here's a New Year song for those of us who are still far away from spiritual enlightenment.
Hey, Pops, what's the matter with you, man? Here it is, New Year, and you're sitting over there like you salted the world.
Yes, I'm salty. I've been misled, I've been mistreated, and I've been misused.
Boy, she really made a chunk out of you.
Yeah, but I made a New Year's resolution, and I'm really going to get her told.
What you going to tell her?
I tell you what I'm going to tell her. Get a load of this. I made my New Year's resolution. Tell you what I'm going to do. Just forget about the old year and the things we used to do. Going to take instead of giving, cause my lesson I've learned. Going to get the things I wanted and give nothing in return. Cause I've changed my ways. And I don't care what you do. I've made my New Year's resolution, and baby, this time we're through. I'm gonna deal 'em from the bottom. Ain't gonna play it fair at all. Please believe me, pretty baby, I'm gonna have myself a ball. Gonna give up my apartment, and you know they're hard to find. I don't want no last year's memories running through my weary mind, cause I've changed my way. And I don't care what you do. Yes, I've made my New Year's resolution, and baby, this time we're through. My way of living, you don't fit in my new plan, so you might as well forget it and go find another man, cause I've changed my way. Yes, I've changed my way. I've made my New Year's resolution, and baby, this time we're through.
That's Roy Milton, recorded in 1947. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Roberta Shirok, who also directs the show. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year from all of us at Fresh Air.